This is the third day of this January 2018 Rohatsu 7-day Sesshin. We'll return to the teachings of the 20th century Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim, reading from the book The Way of Korean Zen. Here, the translator titles this section Stages of Meditation. When people discuss the practice of meditation, they often refer to a person having either a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. Yeah, I think this is something that something I've seen in Chinese texts. In this one, I don't know about Japanese so much. And it's a type of categorizing that I don't think is very useful to anyone. I'm reminded of, I guess this would also be in the Indian tradition, there is a sutra in which the Buddha talks about those of different abilities. This we see in a koan in the Mumonkan. The Buddha answers a non-Buddhist. And here's basically the koan is where a non-Buddhist comes to the Buddha and asks a question. The Buddha responds, and the non-Buddhist comes to awakening, much to the astonishment of Ananda, who never did come to awakening during the lifetime of the Buddha, even though he was the Buddha's attendant. And the Buddha explains to Ananda how it was that this non-Buddhist was able to come to awakening when Ananda himself couldn't. He said he's like a fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip. And this is taken from or reflected in the sutra where the Buddha is talking about different, say, sensitivities to the stark fact of impermanence, the fact of the certainty of our death and the uncertainty of the time of our death, and he compares it to four kinds of horses. He says that one type of person is like someone who reflects on the transient nature of all life. As soon as he hears that someone in another village is about to die, and this is like a horse who runs when it sees just the shadow of the whip. The second type of practitioner reflects on the transient nature of all life when he learns that someone in his own village is about to die. And this, the Buddha said, is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the hair. And the third type of practitioner is one who reflects on the transient nature of all life only when he learns that someone in his own family is about to die. And this is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the flesh. And finally, the fourth kind, who reflects on the transient nature of all life only when he learns that he himself is about to die. And this, the Buddha said, is like a horse who runs when it is whipped to the bone. Notice that the premise, the measure is one's ability to take in the inevitability of one's own death, one's own mortality. And surely we can say that most human beings are like the horse that runs only when it is whipped to the bone. Most human beings have a tremendous capacity to deny death, deny the fact of death, avoid it, seal it up, park it somewhere in the mind where don't have to face it. But what a gift it is to really take it in, this transient nature of life, and to use it. So again, back to our text. He says that this is a common way to classify meditators, whether they have a superior, intermediate, or inferior capacity for this task. And then he says what is absolutely essential to understand is that these capacities are not inborn qualities. For once a strong motivation has been generated, then a person is immediately endowed with a superior capacity. That's why I think it's all too easy, especially for some people who tend to want to classify themselves in one way or another. It's too easy to take this on and then have it to become a hindrance. Oh, I'm the type who has to be shaken to the bone before I get going. I'm the slow horse. And I hear this from people sometimes. After I give a Tay show and I mention this thing, someone, always two or three people will say, oh, I'm the slow horse. Shut up! No, we're not stuck. There's no self. There's no self we're stuck with. This is the great promise of the Dharma, is that we can reshape ourselves, reform ourselves. We're changing ourselves when we're doing serious zazen. We're accelerating our evolution when we're doing it. Yes, maybe when we start out, we can say that make some distinctions like this, but the last thing you want to do is to saddle yourself, pun intended, with these kinds of ideas. And he says, nevertheless, there are different levels of motivation. Some people may leave the care of their parents and relatives and become monks or nuns with a sincere motivation to realize Buddhahood. But after practicing for a while, they discover that the aim of meditation is not achieved as easily as cooling hot cereal by pouring cold water on it. Such persons may become disheartened when their practice does not proceed as smoothly as they had expected. However, a person of superior capacity is able to completely cut off the mind of discrimination as soon as she is told to do so. But for those who are unable to do this, much hardship, effort, and total determination are needed before they can achieve this state. This would be an extremely rare person, a person who can completely cut off the mind of discrimination as soon as she is told to do so. I don't know that I've ever met such a person. Most of us, we have to grind our way through and slowly realize that there's nothing for us in our thoughts, that they may serve us in certain worldly functions in our job and all, of course, they do, but in sitting, in the practice of zazen, they're our worst enemy, these thoughts. And yet people, out of habit, we keep giving way to them. It's habit, more of an addiction. We're addicted to our thoughts. But we can recover from this addiction. It just takes sincere effort, sustained effort. He continues, most people who meditate on a koan intend at the outset to keep a firm hold on it. But usually, after a very short while, their koan disappears and they just lose themselves in delusive thoughts. If someone persists in such a way, when will he ever awaken? Others, after a few initial attempts to hold on to the koan, find that it does not appear to them spontaneously, so they just sit still without doing anything at all. This is not something I've seen often in my teaching career. Such people then ask me, what do you claim there to be? Surely there is just nothing. And then Kusan says, the problem here is that although they tried to hold on to the koan, they found nothing that they could take firm hold of. Thus they conclude that there is nothing at all. But such conclusions are only reached intellectually. Indeed, as long as you continue just to scheme and conceptualize with the intellect, you will find nothing to take firm hold of. But to then proclaim that in reality there is just nothing is mere foolishness. I guess such practitioners may be mouthing this famous statement that we see in calligraphy sometimes, from the very beginning there's never been a single thing. But that perspective is something really that only the awakened have the chops to say. Because the awakened see that it's just, they know it's just half the truth. This nothing. To take it as the whole, to think that emptiness is the answer, is, as Kusan says, is deluded. He continues, it is essential to take a firm hold of the koan and continuously advance in your practice. Well, just to interject, would that it were so that we could just steadily make steady progress like we're going up an escalator. This is not the nature of spiritual practice. The progress we make is in fits and starts. Usually there are better periods and they're followed by worse periods and then alternating again with better periods. And little by little, usually, we find our way out of our thoughts. But no one should ever expect it to be steady progress. Or at least on the surface, for there to appear to be steady. There is continuous progress, even when we go through discouragement or when we get stalled out in our practice. Underneath, there is progress. We can't take surface appearances. And as far as taking firm hold of the koan, well, that's easier said than done. It has a way of being slippery, this koan. I remember feeling that it was like trying to grasp a bar of wet soap. But maybe the mistake in that is thinking that it has to be grasped. It doesn't have to be... it's not a thing that you can grasp. It's a practice that you can settle into with one's full attention. That's different from grasping. But that's the word grasp is used loosely here when he says this, take firm hold of it. He says, this is the same whether you are investigating what is this, mu, or the cypress in the courtyard. These are three different koans. Initially, you do not understand at all what is meant by these questions. Therefore, in order to fully understand their meaning, you must seize hold of the koan and penetrate deeply into it with incessant questioning. It is really very simple. You don't understand what is meant, thus it is necessary to find out through constant questioning. It is, when you step back and look at it, it is simple. You have a question, koan, that you don't understand, you don't get it. So what do when you have a question that you can't answer? You question it. He said, if you did understand, then of course there would be no need for any such questioning. The greatest disease that can affect someone who is meditating on a koan is the absence of any questioning. It is quite meaningless to simply repeat the koan mechanically in your mind without this sense of questioning. Again, I need to step in here and say that, as I did yesterday, I think, that there's another way. It's not just either you're questioning or you're just mindlessly, mechanically saying the question without it being a genuine inquiry. The third way is to be neither questioning nor mechanically muttering the question, but looking directly into it, concentrating fiercely on it, and in that way becoming one with it. This is a great way to practice. It sets up the mind for the arising of genuine questioning from the inside. So three ways of doing this. One is mechanically just reciting the question with your mind somewhere else. That, yes, is what he said, kind of a disease. But there are two valid ways, and one is just the sheer concentration, and then the other, which is ideal, is really wondering. And this is nothing we don't know from our ordinary daily life, this wondering. It's like misplacing your keys. You suddenly have to get out of the house, you have to get to an appointment or something, and you can't find your keys. Where are they? Not by the door where I always leave them. You go up, you check your pants pockets, your purse, they're not there. You look here, you look there, then you start looking at the places that don't make sense. That's how we do it when we're looking for things. You start off with the places that are sensible, and then what else do? You go to the places that don't make any sense until you've exhausted those, and then you're left wondering. Where could they be? Often it brings you to a complete stop. You're just frozen in questioning. This is exactly like questioning or wondering with a koan. It happens only after exhausting all your other answers. When you first try to meditate, you may find that no matter how strong your resolve is to firmly hold the koan, The mind is constantly besieged by wandering thoughts. Gee, who ever heard of that? And it seems impossible to progress in the practice. So what should be done to correct this problem? At such times, you must completely forget about what has happened in the past. For what benefit is there in continuing to think about things that have already ceased? Likewise, you should desist from speculating about what might happen in the future. Because, for since it will be determined by various conditions, what can your present thoughts do to influence the course of future events? And one form of dwelling in the future is worry. David Mamet, the playwright, once said, "Worry is just interest paid on a debt that never comes due." Worry, rehearsing—that's one. Or visualizing something in the future. What a waste of time during Zazen. And the same with dwelling in the past, memories. What a waste of time. It's not that memories can't give us pleasure. Reminiscing about nice things, fond memories, can be quite pleasurable, but it will obstruct our practice. We have to decide, what do we really want? Do we want to entertain ourselves with thoughts of the past or the future? Or do we want to see into the nature of reality? What is it you want? The worst, I think, or one of the worst things, is to be indulging in fantasies at length. I've heard more than once about people who came up with a New Year's skit for Sangha entertainment during a sesshin, and I don't dare ask how much of a script they wrote in their minds in the Zendo here during sesshin. If you're going to want to waste your time that way, don't tell me about it, please. He continues, "Your sole function during a meditation session is to sit on the cushion, investigate your koan, and awaken to its meaning. Other than this, there is nothing to do." So why do you needlessly waste this precious time by entertaining thoughts about what has been and what might be? Now, as soon as you manage to cut off all thoughts of the past and future, you will experience a state of emptiness. This occurs because at that moment, both before and after are severed. If you cannot reach this state because of an inability to control your thoughts about the past and future, then you cannot be considered a true practitioner. Remember, your sole responsibility is to awaken through inquiring into the koan. Again, once before and after have been severed, you enter a state of emptiness. Yeah, what does that mean? Some people are confused about that. A state of emptiness is just a state beyond thought. You're in this space, this spaciousness, in which there are no contents of the mind that you're trafficking in. This is what he means. This is quite an advanced state. He says, now at this time, there is a danger that you might easily slip into a state of just observing the emptiness. In such a condition, you are neither disturbed by sleepiness nor wandering thoughts, but also the koan is also absent. This is a diabolical state to be caught in. It's similar to a makyo, where the koan just disappears. Usually this happens late in sesshin, when thoughts have thinned out, even disappeared. One is getting, drawing quite close to a samadhi with the koan or with the breath, and then all of a sudden, the practice, the koan or the breath, seems to have vanished. You can't find it. It's especially ridiculous when it's the breath. When you know you're breathing, hello, but you can't find, it's not there. People report, I can't find my breath. At such a time, you just have to persist, just do your best to coax back the breath or the koan. And it's not helpful usually to try to force it. That's why I say coax. Try to seduce it back, the awareness of the koan or the breath. But patiently, patiently work with it. Don't panic. It's just a trick of the mind. A kind of a makyo, a side effect of strong concentration. He continues, it is a mistake to merely observe the emptiness. Moreover, you should not even allow the thought to arise that you are not observing it. Likewise, try to discard even the idea that you should not allow such a thought of not observing to arise. He's not done yet. And finally, you should let go of that idea as well. In other words, all observing of the mind, of doing this or that. You will then reach a point where all mental content is relinquished. At that time, since all circumstances are absent, if you take hold of the koan, it will appear with extreme vividness and clarity. By concentrating on the koan in this fashion for a period of a few days, a state of quiescence and vividness will begin to clearly emerge. And then comes the warning. At this time, there is the danger of easily succumbing to the misconception that you've awakened. This is not an experience of awakening. It is merely a perception of the luminous nature of consciousness. Samadhi. Samadhi, or absolute oneness with the practice, is the precondition for awakening, but it's not awakening itself. And then he says, if at such a time you become distracted by circumstances, what is appearing to you will fade and finally become covered up. In other words, you slip away from it and the mind starts refilling. Therefore, make a great effort not to be distracted and instead continue to hold on firmly to the koan. This is, by the way, is why it is so important to take this seriously and keep the eyes down in, when you're in Sesshin, because just flicking your eyes up and seeing something or someone can spawn a whole new set of thoughts. Keeping the eyes down, maintaining silence at all times. This discipline can make all the difference. When you're teetering on the edge of completely losing yourself in a samadhi, this can make the difference of how strict you are with remaining focused, detached from sights. He continues, at this time the koan is said to be ripening and the mind starts to become sharper and more single-pointed like a fine sword. It is vital at this point to pursue your practice with the intensity of an attacking soldier. You must become totally involved with the koan to the exclusion of everything else. If you can make your body and mind become identical with the koan, then in the end, ignorance will naturally shatter. You will fall into a state of complete unknowing, perplexity, and questioning. But even this is not a final or lasting state. When you have reached this point, you must still proceed further to the stage where, although you have ears, you do not know how to hear. Although you have eyes, you do not know how to see. And although you have a tongue, you do not know how to speak. To reach the place where mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers may entail several years of hard practice. Therefore, it is necessary to cast aside all other concerns and train yourself to focus the entirety of your attention on the tasteless koan alone. Tasteless, there's a lot in that word. It can be tiresome to, at times, keep chewing on a koan. At other times it can be exhilarating when we're really absorbed in it. But at other times it can be tiresome, tasteless. But we can't just wait for things to be nice for us to practice. We have to keep chipping away, grinding away at this, even when it's not much fun. And that, by the way, is developing perseverance. It's showing perseverance, but it's developing more perseverance. Even short of awakening, the practice of serious Zen meditation is a practice of developing character. And character is important, not just in terms of the precepts, being a good person, but character is the container, the structure that will hold awakening when it does come. Perseverance, stick-to-itiveness, endurance, fidelity to the practice, commitment. These are rich resources to develop, not just for Zen, the formal Zen practice, but throughout one's life. This, no doubt, is why people come back to Sesshin over and over and over again, even when not having awakened to their true nature, because they realize that this is informing their lives, strengthening their lives, And we don't even have to think of it as preparation for the inevitable suffering of losing people close to us, or the health crisis, terminal illness, diagnosis of terminal illness, or one's own dying. That's all part of this work, is developing these qualities to carry us through these times. He goes on, by proceeding in this way, what is appearing will become even brighter. And after a short while, you will reach a state in which you cannot move an inch in any direction. Even if you wanted to, you could not go forward, nor backward, nor to the right, nor to the left. He's speaking about this feeling of being completely still. There's just no movement of the mind. Hakuin, Zen Master Hakuin, described this as a feeling like you're in a sheet of ice extending 10,000 miles. He says, throughout, the koan remains clear, but you are simply unable to do anything. Moreover, although such a state has been reached, do not allow even the tiniest thought of having realized anything to occur. Such thoughts are a disease of the mind. Instead, in utmost earnestness, hold firmly to the koan and continue with the meditation. With such efforts, you will find that even without consciously raising the koan, it will be present of its own accord. And without consciously thinking of the koan, the awareness of it will always be there. At this time, when you sit, the koan sits. When you stand, the koan stands. And when you lie down, the koan lies down. In other words, this merging, this fusing of subject and object. When this occurs, you can truly say that the koan is present everywhere and that the practice is progressing well. Nevertheless, you must continue to persevere diligently, for there is still the danger of regressing, backsliding. Upon reaching such a state, it is important to consult a wise teacher about how to proceed further with the practice. Because, on the one hand, it is easy to mistake such experiences for an awakening, and, on the other, you simply may be at a loss as to what should next be done. Now, a wise teacher in this case is one who is able to clearly show the way ahead so that your practice can continue to progress. However, there are some teachers who, through a lack of understanding, will tell you to select another koan at this point. But this is not good advice, and such persons are unwise teachers. At this time, that which stands between yourself and awakening is as thin as a single sheet of white paper. Yeah, and that's why it can be difficult for a teacher to discern whether one has turn the mind around, because that last film between oneself and awakening is as thin, it can be as thin as a single sheet of white paper. But I've learned over the years that when in doubt about whether someone might be ready to start working on koan subsequent to one's first koan, it's better to wait. See what comes next. At this time, you need to proceed with the same keen determination and enthusiasm as a beginner. Now the moment has come to raise the final resolve. At the outset of the practice, your resolve can be compared to soaking the straw with which to make sandals in water. I suppose you could say it's like soaking dirty dishes that have a pot or a pot that has food is burned on the bottom. We know that soaking it can help a lot to get that last sediment out of there. Or with laundry, if you have a stain in a shirt or something, then soaking it first can make all the difference. So he's saying, at the outset of your practice is this soaking part. Now, as the practice approaches its goal, your final resolve must be similar to that of someone who has to slash through an impossible knot with a single stroke of his sword. All other concerns must be indiscriminately cast aside. There's a Chinese teacher who described this as that final burst of power. Many people get to they get 97% of the way, but then it's that last 3%, 2%, 1% that requires such a final effort. And the danger is that as this, what he calls soaking, the preliminary practice of soaking the mind becomes more thorough, it can be tempting to just relax into that quietness, that ease. It can be such a relief when we get that far to just take refuge in the stillness of the mind and just coast. And that's exactly what too many people do at that point. Rather than finishing the job. Then he says, if you are to die, then you will die. If you are to live, then you will live. Through developing such determination, the task can now be completed within 1 week. Thus, realizing this to be a very critical moment, you should prepare yourself with all intensity for one more bout. This, then, is the final resolve. For those of you who feel that even this stage is still seems to be pretty remote, still far ahead of you, don't think of it in these linear terms. Don't get attached to this kind of linear progression that Kusan Sunim is saying. The truth is that the mind is already awakened. All of us are already awakened in our true nature. So it's not really a matter of getting anywhere. We're there. It's just opening the eyes. And that doesn't have to follow any particular course. It's really a matter of one's ripeness, one's karma. I remember the first time when I was beginning to teach Li Zexin's, being astonished at some dark horse, someone who seemed to be just flailing in the zendo, mentally flailing, couldn't concentrate, was bothered by physical pain, thoughts, and out of nowhere, they were there. What is that that shifts? There's something mysterious. It is mysterious. I can't explain it. No one can explain it. Something turns in the mind, and they realize that there was never anywhere to go. It's right here. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind matter. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to meditate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless blind matter. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain.